Good morning. Sorry to get started a few minutes later than we should have. I actually was looking for the LFO analyst, Kim Toe, down at her office, and she was out here, and I was down there, and so it's very unusual that I can't find the LFO person. Usually they can't find us. We usually hide out in the building somewhere. So sorry we're getting started late. We're going to have three bills up today, and they're going to be public hearings only. Not going to be any work sessions this morning. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. This is Monday, President's Day, I believe, and it is the 20th of February. Sunny Day is imminent, right? Tomorrow?
From your mouth to God's ears.
It's tomorrow, right?
Really?
We're Sunny Day tomorrow?
I hope the next day,
right?
That would be nice.
First bill up is House Bill 4023. Kim?
Okay. Chair Bates, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the House Committee and the Judiciary with a due pass. House Bill 4023 allows the court to appoint a community guardian and establish the community guardianship of children who are now currently in the custody of the Department of Human Services who are 16 years of age or older.
We have two people signed up for this, and Representative Craig, would you like to come up first?
Yes, that'd be fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs. I'll use co-chairs. Everybody's a co-chair, it seems up there.
We're all co-chairs
and committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krueger, State Representative of District 1, which is the Southern Coast. I'm not going to speak too much about the actual content of the bill, but more about the revenue impact and the fiscal side of it and the issues around that. I believe it's a $26,000 possible savings. That's per child, and these kids are going to be 16 to 18 years of age. We kind of envision in our conversation that you might be having 3 to 4 in guardianship in a home, and if that was to take place, you'd be talking $108,000 a year. $216,000 that last 2 years that they're actually in that home under that guardianship that the charity, in this case the Catholic charities, would not be receiving. They're going to take care of it. There's also a savings that between 18 and 21 for the health care, because that's going to be taken care of also. So the state's going to also save that, and I don't know how much that would be during that period of time. As a side note, I want you to realize that in judiciary, we continue to hear about the number of people in our prison system, like 70% have drug and alcohol problems. But you can put that same number to foster kids that end up somewhere, either in the youth authority or in the prison system during their life, and that's a number that is not acceptable. That is not acceptable to have those kids come out after whatever time they've been in foster care. And I had 12 foster kids. Luckily, none of them went down that track. Maybe it was because I wore a blue uniform, was pretty strict. Probably some of the things I did might have been questionable. But they're decent citizens. I want you to realize that in my mind, this is probably the most important bill that came out of judiciary this year. There were a lot of little fix-it bills and things we always see, but I think as far as a lasting impact on children, and unfortunately, especially right now in this session, we're looking at the revenue impact of the state's budget. But it has good benefit to the revenue, it has good benefit of its good policy, and most importantly to me, it is in fact a benefit to the kids on their way to becoming adults. I'll leave it there if you have any questions.
Any questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krueger, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. I just want to clarify, I'm a new foster parent myself. I have three new foster daughters, one of whom is 16. Help me understand the origin of this bill, the genesis of it, and what problem it's specifically trying to address in addition to the fiscal one.
The one who can best address that would be the judge that's going to come up.
Okay.
I did work with the judges regarding the concept and a little problem that had developed.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Krueger, any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for sharing this morning with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming up. Good to see you again. Hope Curry County's still there when you go home.
I don't know.
I don't know. Does We have signed up here the Catholic Community Services Group. Is anybody else wanting to speak to this? The Supreme Court would like to speak, and we will all stand at attention when this is adjourned.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiske, I'm here for Catholic Community Services, and as you said, so implied, Mr. Chair, my purpose is to mostly bask in the glow of those to my right, and my purpose is to introduce them to you. I should say first, thank you for hearing this bill. It comes to you with a strong endorsement from House Judiciary. Representative Krieger, this is his priority bill for this session. I would tell you that Representative Mary Nolan from the committee had hoped to be here this morning as well to share with you her support for this bill, and obviously Representative Nolan can speak for herself rather than me speaking for her. I want to basically introduce to you two people. The first person to my right is Jim Seymour, who is the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services in the Mid-Willamette Valley area, three counties, and Jim will be able to answer Senator Steiner Hayward your question specifically. Obviously, to my far right is the Chief of the Oregon Supreme Court, Paul DeMunis, who, along with Senator Winters, has been instrumental with Catholic Community Services in bringing you first this bill in this February session, as well as five more individual pieces of legislation that are planned to be brought to you in the 2013 legislative session. And Chief DeMunis and Senator Winters have our thanks for the good work they've done with us in this community under the label the Fostering Hope Initiative. With that, Mr. Chair, and with your indulgence, I'll turn to Mr. Seymour.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley and Central Coast. CCS is a state-licensed and nationally accredited social service agency that serves more than 3,000 of our community's most vulnerable children, youth, and families each year. On any given day, approximately 100 children wake up in a safe, stable, nurturing home provided by Catholic Community Services. This number represents only 10% of the Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County foster children, but it's the 10% with the most serious emotional and behavior problems. These kids have not thrived in regular foster care. Their families are either unwilling or unable to do what it takes to reclaim them, and no one has stepped forward to adopt them. Well, actually, some of the kids we serve have been adopted, but the adoptions have failed and the kids re-enter the foster care system. That was the case with Ricky Ruiz, whose story you have in front of you. It's on page 27 in the magazine. It's featured there. And Ricky puts his story this way. The first 7 years of my life were pretty good, but then moms got hooked on drugs. From that point on, everything started falling apart. She and Dad would fight all the time. When Dad left, Mom started bringing home boyfriends that were drug users. Bad things happened to my brother and me. Dad tried to protect us by having us live with Grandma, but I was so angry I wouldn't let her care for me. In the next few years, I was in six different foster homes. I kept getting into trouble, and each time the foster parents asked my caseworker to move me. When I first came to the community home, I thought it was one more place that would give up on me, so I started getting in trouble. They didn't give up. I was held accountable, but they didn't kick me out, and I started doing better. In fact, I did so well that I was adopted. The adoptive home was great, but the state discovered my adoptive dad had abused a child before, and they pulled me out. My only request was that I go back to the community home. It was hard to lose hope of being adopted, but I liked the community home and felt supported. My experience there had its ups and downs, but the stability of being in one home, even if the foster parents left, gave me the sense of security. I stayed in the same school and neighborhood until I graduated from high school and was on my own. When Ricky was 16, he joined the ROTC program at North Salem High School. After graduating from North Salem High School, he joined the National Guard. We were there at Fort Benning, Georgia, when he graduated from boot camp. After boot camp, Ricky served a tour of duty in Iraq and today works full-time as a bank teller in Woodburn. By the time Ricky was 16, he did not need to be in foster care. He had completely turned his life around and wanted out of the system, and yet he had to stay in for two more years at a cost to taxpayers of more than $40,000. House Bill 4023 gives youth like Ricky the opportunity to successfully leave foster care when they turn 16 by electing to ask a juvenile court judge to place them in community guardianship with a state-licensed agency like Catholic Community Services. Community guardianship youth will continue to live in the same safe, stable, nurturing home as long as they are a minor, and then they will receive all the support they need to successfully get out on their own. In short, community guardianship achieves better outcomes for foster youth and saves taxpayer money. I believe the fiscal impact statement you have received may be accurate in the short run, but dramatically understates the cost savings over time. We believe that in time, the cost savings will be closer to $400,000 per year in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties alone. Thank you very much.
Judge, would you like to introduce yourself to us,
please? Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Paul DeMunez. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. However, I appear here in my individual capacity as a member of the community and somebody who has worked closely with Catholic Community Services over the years, particularly with regard to foster care. I'm involved with Senator Winters and others in a cutting-edge program in Marion and Yamhill County called Fostering Hope, which seeks to basically intervene in the lives and prevent maltreatment to children, reduce the number of children entering foster care by intervening in a neighborhood program before that ever occurs. I want Jim to say one thing when I finish here. This bill arises out of a unique program we have called Community Homes in Marion and Yamhill County, and I'd like Jim to explain that to you so you understand where this comes from. My understanding is there are no other programs like Community Homes in the state, and I'm hoping that by gaining this information, you'll learn how this is a policy that ought to be something to think about in the future. So I think this is a very important bill. I think Senator Steiner Hayward, we'd ask Mr. Seymour to answer your question for you. Thank you.
Judge Avinas, I want to thank you for coming here this morning. I know you're very busy. We're actually honored to have you with us, and I appreciate your insight and wisdom.
Thank you.
And Mr. Seymour, I'm going to make sure I understand this bill carefully. This is for children, or kids, I suppose I should say, and adults 16 to 18, basically, who are sort of trapped in the foster system right now. Without this bill, it's difficult to get them into the kind of programs you're talking about. Is that correct?
Senator Bates, members of the committee, these kids usually come to us when they're 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, but the community guardianship couldn't go in effect until they were 16 years old. So many of them have been in foster care since the time they were 1, 2, 3 years old. They've grown up in foster care. They've bounced around from home to home. And now when they turn 16 years old, usually the state has had anywhere from 3 to, 13 years to find them a permanent home, and they haven't found one. And now if the young person at 16 finally elects, I'd like to successfully leave foster care before I age out of the system at 18, and then if a court orders it after looking at all the evidence that this would really be in their best interest, they then could spend the last 2 years in out of state custody.
Could you answer Senator Steiner Hayward's question first? I think Senator Winters probably has some information for us also.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, in my experience, and I have 40 years of experience now, the foster care system in Oregon is a good system for the vast majority of the kids. One of the things that we see is in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County, for example, we have about 80 children that enter the system every month, and we have about 80 children that successfully leave. And they work very hard. The state works very hard at getting those kids placed. But there's a small group of kids. We think it's about 5% of all of the kids that are in foster care who simply don't thrive there. And they come to our community homes. Their lives get turned around. They want to get out of foster care. They want to lead a more normal life. When Ricky was in the ROTC program, he couldn't go to a swimming pool where there wasn't a lifeguard because he was a foster kid. And here he is. He can't be in the ocean in water over his knees. And here he is with his ROTC group without breaking a rule. So there's when, and then there's just just the sense there's a community who's willing to care for these kids, who long to care for our kids. We don't see these as the state's children. These children were taken into protective custody while they were living in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County, and Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County residents are willing to assume responsibility for the costs of the care for these kids as well. And so we have a principle that we call subsidiarism, which just means things should be handled at the closest level to the family that it's possible, and whoever can do the best job. So it fits with that principle as well. I hope that answers your question, Senator.
It does. Thank you very much. And I actually had one of my foster daughters here with me last Wednesday, so it was nice for her to see what this is like. I wish she'd been here today.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and your honor. Thank you for... He and I have done several joint appearances together on this particular issue and other issues that face our community. And I, just for the record, what is occurring in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties is the recognition that communities have a larger role to play and involvement with children. One, to try to stem the tide and intervening early. Jim talked about the community homes. It's very unique. I wish other places around the state had a similar kind of program. It's a public-private venture. It's where the child remains within their community so that they're not being the one that's bounced around. In our current system, we move children from place to place to place. It's not unusual to have foster children who have been in multiple, sometimes 12 to 13 different placements. The concept behind community homes is that they remain within their community. If anyone moves, it's the foster parents. It's the parents of the home. That's one piece. And the other piece that's involved is the guardianship. And then we began here under Jim Seymour's leadership and those that are involved with Catholic community of looking at totally how can we as a community address the needs of children early. How can we provide those resources inside the community that makes these young people, these kids, really feel that they belong and that they're not shuffled from place to place, keeping within their school districts, so that they're not changing. So there's a lot going on, and this is just one component of many as we begin to try to address the needs of children and to keep them from graduating into our other systems. And I'm very, very pleased to be involved with Your Honor and Jim Seymour and others in this community as we try to not only talk about dollars, because this is not about dollars, and I need to put that on the record. It is about children. It is about making certain that children are nurtured, making sure that they're healthy, and making sure that the results are the best for them. So I needed to share that with you.
I appreciate it, Senator Winters. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Winters. Any other questions? I have just a quick one, if I could, Your Honor. I think you're the best one to ask this to. I, too, have had the experience of taking in about 15 foster kids at not the same time, sort of sequentially. And many of the kids were 14 or 15 when you brought them in. It seemed like a sort of a breakthrough, right, about high school age and when they started having some special needs and they come to stay at our farm. And we kept them in the same high school the way through. So what was the system about age 16 instead of age 14 or 15 or the beginning of the high school years? Is there a legal reason you can't go lower than that, or just is this the way the program works? You don't want to take them any younger? Or it seemed like kind of an artificial thing.
Yeah. Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, I'll do the best I can to answer that, and then ask Jim Seymour if I don't get it exactly right. But in working this way, and in all the discussions and the years of talking about this, first of all, the children that we're talking about are the children for which there is no other permanent designation.
Right.
You understand
that's we did too. Right.
Okay. And it seemed to me, as we were talking about this, that it was about that time at age 16. When there is no other permanency plan, that to say as a community, you belong with us. We take responsibility for you. And to imbue in those children this idea, and we all know as parents who've raised children, there's a lot more after 18. and this is part of that. This is part of that whole concept of you have a place to go, you have somebody to call, you have people who literally care for you. There'll be adults, you know, literally who are assigned as the physical presence and loving presence of the guardian. It's not just Catholic Community Services as an agency. So it just seemed, as at least from my perspective, that was about the right time to do that. Jim?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, part of it is we really do believe that Oregon has a pretty good foster care system, and so they work hard to get kids placed in regular guardianship, to get children adopted. Ricky was 13 when he was adopted, and so we want, on a principled reason, to have the state working as long as they can to find an alternative to community guardianship. The only thing that's worse is to stay an age out of foster care, so we just don't want to do it too soon. The other thing is just a practical matter. There are certain benefits that if the kids were to become in community guardianship sooner than that there's certain public benefits that they would lose, that they won't lose by waiting until they're 16 before they move into community guardianship.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might just make three quick comments as we leave the witness table. One, thank you for your consideration. We appreciate it, knowing your schedule. Secondly, in your wisdom, we respectfully would ask you to move this bill to work session in your committee. We would appreciate that if you can see your record to do that. And then lastly, I do want to indicate that Judge Nan Waller from Multnomah County is in the audience today, and she has been helpful to us along the way in this bill track this session, and I just wanted to acknowledge her presence as well.
Thank you all for coming down. Any further questions? Seeing them, I think we'll probably be moving us to a work session as quickly as possible. I'll check with co-chair.
Thank you.
Your Honor, thank you for coming down today.
Thank you.
I always appreciate seeing you.
Thank you.
Did Judge Waller want to speak also?
Let me just simply say...
I mean, I'm rarely in a room with you. You don't want to speak, so it's simple.
Judge Nan Waller, presiding judge from Multnomah County, and all of the things I would agree with the things that have been said. There are certain financial benefits in terms of eligibility for funding for college that age 16 makes sense. The tuition waiver bill that you all passed. Children have to have been in foster care for a year before age 16. So there are some reasons why the age 16 makes sense. In response to Senator Steiner Hayward, every effort is made to come up with permanency plans for children. There are some children, given the attachment reactive disorder, that it is very hard to make attachment to a family. Place-based for this small group of kids makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Judge Warren, while you're there, because you just talked about the one that's hard to place in, and the good co-chair and I have been very concerned about the disproportionate population and how difficult that is to place. That's the particularly African Americans and Native Americans and that population. Do you think that this, if we pass the guardianship, that would assist that population as well?
I think any permanency that we can give to children who've been in foster care up until age 16, before, whether it's placement with a person or place-based permanency, is imperative. And so for that population who we see in greater number staying longer in care, and children of color stay in care longer and age out at a much higher rate. And so that is a group that we absolutely need to make certain that we have a level of permanency so that they can stay in school, because the level of foster children who do not complete high school is greater than our already abysmal high school completion rate in Oregon. And so it is a group of children that we hope always to have the highest level of permanency, and I'm confident and I know that that's exactly what Catholic Community Services does. If we can find a family, that's the best plan. But if we can't, then we want to make sure that we at least have place-based permanency, and having the community support the completion of high school going on to higher ed, it should be the same for every child in foster care as it is for every one of our own children. We should have the same expectations. So, yes, I think that it will help address that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
We're going to change the schedule a little bit. We have people in the audience I know want to speak to 1577, so we're going to jump into 1577 and come back to the other bill afterwards. So, Senator Rosenbaum, I expect you're going to lead us off this morning on 1577. Linda, you want to lead us to the bill real quick?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1577 requires state agencies to participate in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, subject to certain exceptions. The fiscal is indeterminate and depends on the purchasing power, competitiveness of that prescription drug program compared to other purchasing groups. I did want to alert you that there is an ongoing study. Department of Corrections and the Prescription Drug Program are in the process of doing an evaluation to see if this program would save corrections money. Last fall, they did a retrospective comparison for fiscal year 2011. However, that methodology had some flaws. For instance, there were less than half of the medications that had a direct match for comparison. So the two programs are now in the process of doing a real-time comparison for 90 days, and we expect that we'll have those results in May.
Just a bit late.
Thank you. Any questions for LFO before we start testimony? Senator Rosenbaum, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairs, Madam Co-Chair, and members of the committee, and happy Washington's birthday. I think, and for the record, I'm State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21. I think it's a great way to celebrate our great presidents, Lincoln and Washington, by scheduling Senate Bill 1577 for a hearing, because they were certainly presidents who knew the value of a penny and a dollar, and that's what this bill is indeed all about. You know, we talk a lot this session in particular about being accountable with the scarce resources that we have and government efficiency and stretching every dollar we have to put the most into the critical services that Oregonians need. I think this committee probably knows better than almost any committee in the building about how crucial it is to do that. And that's indeed what Senate Bill 1577 is all about. As you know, in 2003, the legislature authorized the formation of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and it was set up in order to unite Oregon's drug purchasing power to leverage the best prices on effective medicine by pooling the purchasing power of both the state and individuals who were able to participate in it. It has grown and been remarkably successful over those years, and literally allowed hundreds of thousands of people to save many, many untold dollars. And participation in this program for state agencies who can choose to purchase pharmaceuticals on their own through another purchasing agreement with less buying power is optional currently. So that is what this bill would change. And the bill is really very simple. It just says that if agencies are not currently participating, they must participate in the OPDP or be able to show that they are saving more money through another purchasing arrangement. Some of the significant agencies have already been referred to that are not currently participating, including the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Public Employee Benefit Board. The study was referenced that was done as a result of last year's legislature requiring a study to be done that showed that corrections alone would save as much as $1.4 million a year based on roughly half of their drug purchases. So clearly there is a lot of money that stands to be gained. And even more savings are potentially available to be realized if entities like the Public Employee Benefits Board were to come on board. A potential savings, a conservative amount, would be for PEB to be able to save approximately $5.1 million a year. Obviously, that's a much larger group that would increase the purchasing power of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. So That's simply what the bill does. I think that there has been a lot of confusion about whether money would actually be saved or whether you could do better through another arrangement. And I think it's really important to keep coming back to the fact that if you save more money in another purchasing arrangement, there's nothing in this bill that would require you to give that up. That would be nonsensical to do. It's just a bill about accountability and efficiency and making sure we're getting the most bang for the buck and being able to get the savings that Oregonians expect us to get in these times of scarce resources. I wanted to just point out a couple of other things before I close, and you'll, I'm sure, hear from other people about this, but it is important to note that we merged our prescription drug bulk purchasing program a few years ago with the state of Washington. In order to have more power, we, the two states, decided to get together. And it, you can look across the border and see some of the changes that Washington State has made, like having their equivalent of our Public Employee Benefit Board system participate in purchasing drugs through this purchasing pool. So that's where some of the information about the cost savings is coming from. And then finally, I wanted to mention that there is, this bill did come unanimously to you from the Senate Health Committee, as the Senate co-chair well knows. There is a technical amendment to the bill that was a drafting oversight, and that is the -A5 amendment that just removes an additional reference to purchasing that applies to Medicaid drugs. That was removed in the original amendment, and there was another place in the bill. I believe it's on page 3 of the bill, section 2. So this amendment, once you do take this up in a work session, would take out that language which was intended, and I think all parties agree. So I would commend the bill to you. Thank you very much for scheduling it in your busy day in a public hearing, and hopefully you will be able to take this bill up and vote it out soon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Questions?
I don't have a question, but I would like to follow up on your comments, and says the one of the subcommittee co-chairs for public safety's budget, and which did the budget note, to ask for the study, and who've been following this and working with both DOC and the Oregon Health Authority. The $1.4 million was in question as to whether or not that was valid, and it still is. I mean, when you raise it, I thought I need to clarify it, because it has been questionable as to whether or not there is that kind of savings, because DOC does not believe it, and that's why there's going to be another one done, because it wasn't, the original one wasn't apples to apples, you know, or oranges to oranges, and until we get that very scientific base of really what we're looking at. The other part of the discussion is whether or not, particularly in the case of DOC, where they're a part of a multi-state and governmental pool currently. So we have to look at, you know, whether or not by joining and all of those. But I just need to clarify that for you, Senator, that the 1.4 has been ballied out there as a number. It's not something that has been verified, however.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters. I did not know, actually, that there was an additional study, because this was the study that I was referring to was the one that was produced as a result of the legislature's budget language last time. But I do think it's important to keep coming back to this simple premise that if money is not going to be saved by participating in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, then there's no requirement under this bill to participate in it. And really, why would you give up a better deal if you're getting a better deal somewhere else? But it certainly, to me, stands to reason, I think it would to most of our constituents, that since this program has saved countless thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars for Oregonians, if money stands to be saved to the state of Oregon, I think we would be derelict in our duty if we don't do that. So that's really all the bill is saying, and I would commend it to you.
Representative Freeman.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you for bringing, Senator, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm still trying to understand the need for it. So I get that we want to save money. I'm trying to understand why we're having to require people to do something. It's my understanding they can already participate in it. I mean, is there some reason why state agencies can't use this way of buying drugs now?
Well, there's certainly nothing that prevents it, but obviously I think, you know, there are several instances where it's not happening. And I think just like many other bills that are moving forward this session, things that might have been a good idea, you might say, well, why didn't we do that all along? But I think the laser-like focus we have on the budget this session has caused a lot of more intense responsibility by the legislature to just make things that were permissive mandatory.
Senator, thank you. And I guess I just find it sort of fascinating that we have this program in place that's designed to save money, and we're now having to put a bill in place to force agencies to save money. I don't understand. I mean, it seems to me as if they're not going to do it under the current ability to do it. Forcing them, they're just going to find a reason not to do it anyway. So I'm a little mixed on this.
Well, I'll just make a comment. It wouldn't be the first time my experience is spilling that if you don't force agents to do something, sometimes they don't do it. They do save money. I can think of natural resources and other areas where we actually force them to do something, end up saving a lot of money. They just didn't get around to doing it. But what I want, while this bill is, we want to make sure that if we're saying to them, there must be a good solid study showing that money will be saved, then you go ahead and do it. Yeah. And that's the key to this whole bill. I think the real key is going to come down to who do you believe about saving the money? And that's where it gets a little tricky sometimes.
Senator?
Yes.
I agree with everything you just said. And I think you really got to the end there where you said they're going to come up with whatever study to show whatever, and we're going to end up having competing studies, which sounds like it's going on right now. So I just, again, if an agency doesn't want to do something, it's been my experience, they figure out a way not to do it.
I've had that experience too, unfortunately. Further questions? Thank you, Senator. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Next on the list is Dr. Robert Gluckman.
Good morning, and thank you to the members of the Senate and House for having me here this morning. My name is Bob Gluckman. I'm an internal medicine physician. I'm the chief medical officer for Providence Health Plans, and I'd like to provide testimony that opposes this bill, or at least ask you to consider one of the amendments that I think would make this bill stronger. There are several points that I'd like to raise, the first one being the comment about the current, based on the information that's currently available on the OPDB website and what we know about Providence Health Plan's purchasing power, if we look at the 25 most prescribed drugs, both on frequency and on total cost, our estimate that this bill, by mandating the use of OPDP on a hypothetical 100,000 patient population, would cost the state somewhere between $3 and $5.5 million more than purchasing through OPDP. But I think that more importantly, the bill as currently written overemphasizes only unit drug costs when considering the overall impact of pharmacy costs on healthcare costs. There are other factors that are also in play that I think are also very, very important for the legislature to consider. One of those would have to do with formulary management, so that if one plan has higher generic use rates than another, so I can tell you that in our commercial population, our generic use rates are in the low 80s. If generic use rates are not matched by another program, that it will cost the state more money. Most importantly, I'd like to emphasize the benefits of integration between pharmacy benefits and having access in real time to claims data when our case and disease managers can also use that information to look at how patients are currently being treated so that we can optimize their medical therapy. So as an example, if a patient has diabetes and then in our case and disease management programs, our case and disease management nurses who interact with the patients and interact with the clinicians can see in real time what the patient is actually filling. They can then have that discussion with the patient, but also with the patient's treating providers. That benefit of integration will be completely lost by carving out the management of pharmacy to an independent agency. I would point out that the bill is currently written does give this exemption to patients who are enrolled in an HMO like Kaiser. However, if the committee would consider these dash three amendments that have been submitted, which would allow for integrated pharmacy benefit management programs to be exempt from the bill, then the state would continue to have the opportunity to have the benefit. Those patients would have the benefit of having of integration, of being able to integrate in real time pharmacy claims data to their overall disease management. That will be lost through the OPDP because we don't have access to those real time claims data. I would also kind of comment that the state and its other other healthcare legislation is emphasizing the benefits of the CCOs, the coordinated care organizations, the benefits of integrating mental health and dental care into the overall cost of healthcare. When you're looking at the management of patients with chronic illness, pharmacy claims is an integral part of their chronic disease management. When that's carved out, I view this as inconsistent with the other programs and other healthcare redesign and transformation that the state is recognizing as essential to optimize the health of the patient population. And then lastly, from an administrative simplification point of view, this would require that patients enroll in multiple different programs. If they have customer service needs or benefit questions, they're going to have to call multiple different agencies, and that's inefficient for them and confusing for them, and all those things have costs. So when I added up the from our information on the most prescribed drugs in terms of both frequency and cost, the direct costs of this program would be higher than our current costs. That it fails to consider other important impacts on total healthcare costs, like the generic use rates. It fails to consider the benefits of integration from pharmacy claims in real time, which can look at adherence rates and provide advice to both patients and to providers. And then lastly, the administrative complexity that it would add. And I would ask that I recognize that there are some state agencies that would clearly benefit from this bill. But those that are cared for by carriers with integrated pharmacy benefit programs will likely suffer. The cost would likely be higher. Some of that conflict could be alleviated by your consideration of the Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you, Dr. Gluckman. Welcome this morning and have a chance to say good morning to you. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gluckman, could you just clarify one thing for me? I understand your points entirely, and the coordination of care issue is completely clear. If you look at page 2 of the current A and the current A version of 1577, line 38 says, agencies' other purchasing arrangements will result in greater discounts and aggregate cost savings than would be realized through participation in the program. Would aggregate cost savings not include the cost savings realized by coordination of care, or would you consider that too difficult to track, or help me understand that a little bit better?
Yeah, I don't think it's very well defined, and my understanding of the bill, and perhaps I'm incorrect in that understanding, is that the determination of the aggregate cost would be made by the director of the OPDP, and whether or not they're going to be able to take a look and look at the total cost savings of what the impact of the program was, that may be difficult. So I think it's not specific enough, and so therefore we think that, based on our evidence, based on I think previously we've presented you with information that looks at the emergency room rates and the inpatient utilization rates of patients in Providence Health Plan with the five most chronic diseases, and shows that it's about half the national average. I would kind of comment on Representative Freeman's earlier comments about his question about what's the need for this bill if other state agencies already have the opportunity to save money. I think there's a question as to why aren't they doing it, and I think there are some state agencies that would clearly benefit, I think, from what we've heard about Department of Corrections, and I don't know enough about how they currently manage their pharmacy benefits. What I do know is that based on our work, that this bill will clearly cost the state more money, if the pharmacy benefits are taken out of our integrated case management.
Follow up, Senator.
Mr. Co-Chair, is it permissible for me to ask Mr. Burns a question since he's here with us today relating to this issue?
Absolutely.
Mr. Burns, would you mind joining us for a minute, please?
Dr. Gluckman, I'm going to ask a question on his way up here.
Sure.
And you may not have the answer this morning. I actually tried to find out this morning and couldn't. Your contract with PEB Is it a global contract per member per month basis, or are there carve-outs within a hospital, physician fees, and pharmacy, or is it a global budget?
So in our contract with PEB, we are administrative services only. They're a self-insured carrier. We create all those networks with the one exception of behavioral health, where there's an independent network where we work tightly with them.
Does the present contract say basically that without a change of the contract, that if you carved out pharmaceutical benefits, that had to be to carve those out and bring savings to the state, that the contract had to be changed?
I'm not sure. If you could,
here's my point. Let me make it simpler, if I could. Let's say we put this program together and it goes through, and hypothetically it does save money, but the contract is per member per month. Is there any savings to the state on that basis, even if that were to occur?
There would be, because they pay the medical costs if there was a savings on the per unit cost. On the other hand, I would say that if the overall medical costs go up because of the loss of integration, then PEB would lose money.
I understand that.
And the administrative services only contract, I can't speak to the details of the contract, but the amount of the contract that would be paid to Providence Health Plan simply for the administration of the pharmacy benefit, I think, is relatively small. So we come here today not because we think that there's this huge amount of money that's coming to Providence Health Plan from administering this. We think it'll make the job of actually improving the health of the patients who are covered by the state infinitely more difficult and much more complex. And it actually just speaks to all the other benefits that you're trying to implement through the CCOs. This is completely different than the philosophy. This bill is completely different than the philosophy of trying to integrate benefits through a CCO by having seamless access to all the data. This bill would take that away. So it doesn't make much sense to it from that point of view.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Burns.
Co-chairs, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority, and the OPDP program sits within my purview. So I'm not quite sure where you want to go from here. Shall I ask?
Could I ask a couple of fairly specific questions to both you and Dr. Gluckman simultaneously with the chair's permission?
Absolutely.
Thank you. The first is this. Understanding that I'm putting you on the spot, and you may not have an immediate answer to this, how would you interpret the phrase aggregate cost savings, and how would you anticipate that OPDP would use that in calculating relative savings of different plans?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, as I said in the policy committee, to me aggregate is aggregate, and that I would look at it as the total health cost to PEB to cover the state employees.
So in other words, you would in fact take into consideration the cost savings that Dr. Gluckman is telling us about that come from coordinating the care and being aware of whether patients are actually complying with getting their prescriptions filled and on a regular basis, things like that.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, I would, but I do need to comment about the data sharing. I fail to see how the data sharing is an issue. When a pharmacy processes a claim, the claim becomes available to whomever wants it. And I will just tell a little story about Providence. As some of you will recall from the policy committee, there is a bill moving through right now that the Central Oregon Consortium wants because they're after the data for the mental health drugs in the CCO model. And we have found a way to share that data with the CCOs, including Providence and their pharmacy plans. So the OPDP program is nothing more than a purchasing program. It is not a paying program. It is not a controlling program. It works with the plans. The plans say this is what we want our drug benefit to look like, and we go out and purchase drugs. So the generic argument, the generics are controlled by the plan. The plan controls the prescribers, and the prescribers decide what the generic utilization is, not OPDP. All OPDP does is consolidate purchasing because of our buying power through both what we have in Oregon and what we have with the state of Washington and get better discounts.
So you're starting to answer one of my next questions. So that means I'm a PEB, Providence Statewide Insured, okay? I come right under Dr. Gluckman's plan. And today, if I go to the pharmacy and fill a prescription, then that claim goes directly into Providence's database, and Dr. Gluckman and his colleagues can have appropriate access to that to make sure I'm taking my medication as prescribed. Were Providence to participate in OPDP, as you're describing, the only difference would be that instead of the drug that I pick up from the pharmacy having been purchased by Providence, it would have been purchased by OPDP, but the claim would still go to Providence. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, that is absolutely the way the program would work.
Dr. Gluckman, you look dubious.
Well, I spoke with our, you know, and again, this is, you know, Helen Noonan Harnsberg is our director of pharmacy. I spoke with her about this issue on mental health, and she's not here, and so I don't have technical expertise to answer that. But what I've been told is that we don't have that access in real time, and that the data transfer that Mr. Burns is talking about is not as seamless as he would make it to be. Now, I wish Helen were here, because if the data transfer is not seamless, then this would be a, you know, very significant impact. And our concern here is being able to be sure that we have real-time data. If the OPDP, if it's just purchasing, we have the same access to the same data, and it's just as seamless as it currently would be, and that there's no administrative complexity to it, then, you know, we would not be sitting here concerned about it, because we're not purchasing. The drug cost is completely borne by the state in this circumstance. So my understanding, based on the information I have, is that the data transfer is not seamless, and that it's not what it's been presented to be. But Helen Noonan Harnsberger could give more information about that.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you both for this dialogue. It's fascinating to me. One thing I can tell you, and this is more of a statement, but I do have a question, is that the data is not seamless. As you described, I hear constantly from the community that I live in that's trying to create a CCO the difficulty in getting the data, to the point when the governor's there in the room with us, that's all they want to talk about is how difficult it is to get the data from the Oregon Health Authority. So to sit here and say, oh yeah, the data is just seamless, is completely inconsistent with my community and the experience they've had working with the health authority. I'm so pleased to hear you say that you fixed that and somehow it's going to be all better. I'm really looking forward to that. My question is more around the discussion that you brought up around the generics and the purchasing of generics. You referenced another bill that's working the process. There is a bill about generic purchasing that has been reported that you don't believe is ready to move forward, and so it's not moving forward. So I'm curious as to comments about one bill that you think you've solved the problem and we're not going to need the bill, and another bill that seems to me like is right in line with this particular discussion that isn't ready. So do you have any comment on the generic bill that's held up?
Representative Freeman, members, the generic bill is a Medicaid bill.
Yes,
this bill is not a Medicaid bill, and that's the difference.
So we're okay outside of Medicaid, but Medicaid we're not going to do this.
There's federal discounts.
Medicaid, we do have the authority to go out and negotiate rebates for Medicaid generic products, and we are in the process of trying to figure out how to do that. This bill is, there is no prohibition of us going and negotiating generics as part of a whole bundled package for this bill. Medicaid's a little more difficult because we live under federal law and have some difficulties about how to make that work. But I do think that there's a real chance that we can do that. But I just don't know. But as I said, this bill is not a Medicaid bill. This bill does not impact Medicaid. And the generic mandatory purchasing program would not be impacted by this bill one way or the other.
Representative, sorry, do you want to follow up?
If technically amended into this bill, it could. It's got a great relating clause, this bill does.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to comment on the generic bill. I mean, you decide what you want to do with amending that is. We are working with Representative Widener to try and understand and work with his concerns. So, that's your call. I do want to make one other comment. Dr. Gluckman said that he compared the prices of the 25 most used drugs against our posted prices. I just need to remind you that posted prices are like with anything that is posted when it's variable. That's the price. The list price. What you cannot see in that price is the back-end rebates or the back-end contracting prices that you have, because we can't post those. Those are contractually controlled. We get those on the back end by collecting rebates. And so a comparison against a non-rebated drug, which is what the posted price is, against the rebated drug, is an invalid and incorrect comparison.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. This has been a fascinating hearing. It seems to be a lot of layers to this onion. I'm wondering how would this actually work? Say XYZ agency says, we believe that what we're currently doing, not through the OPDP, is saving us money. Will you accept that, or will there have to be a particular way of calculating savings?
Well, let's use the Department of Corrections as an example of how we are currently making this work. We sat down with the Department of Corrections, developed the process to look at the price of drugs, and came up with an analysis. That analysis had a few flaws in it, not the least of which is there were a number of drugs that did not have a comparison price. It also had some flaws because a great deal of the savings occurs in the generic market, and we committed the DOC to compare exactly identical drugs. Unfortunately, in the generic market, the term identical drug, as we think of it, doesn't hold. The chemical entity is identical. The delivery system is identical, but they're made by two different manufacturers. And so I will make it a simple analogy. It's like milk. A cow in Tillamook makes milk, and that is sold to Fred Meyer. A cow in Umatilla makes milk, and that's sold to Safeway. The price is different between the two stores because of whatever various reasons it is to make the price difference. When we looked at DOC, DOC bought the milk from Fred Meyer. We got a better deal by buying milk from Safeway. It's exactly the same chemical entity, it's exactly the same product, but it is not the identical comparison. And we pledged to DOC when we started this process to do an identical comparison. So they wanted us to say, what could we get it for if we bought milk from Fred Meyer? So we don't have a contract with Fred Meyer, but we do have a contract with Safeway, and we can get it for you better price. Well, no, we really want a comparison with Fred Meyer. And so that's the analysis that we've gone back to the table to try and figure out how to do. The other problem with the data that Senator Rosenbaum talked about with the 1.4 million is it was a snapshot. We looked at 1 year's worth of data and compared the price on a particular day. Well, in the pharmaceutical world, the prices change sometimes hourly. And so in order to be a fair comparison, we needed to compare. They buy a drug today. What does DOC pay for it? What does OPDP pay for it? And you have to do it that way in order to come to a true number. And that process is ongoing. You commented about an onion. I've been in this business for over 20 years. And even I, opening up this onion, find things inside that I didn't expect to find, as Representative Freeman said, the whole generic issue in the Medicaid market. Just something that when you start peeling back the onion and looking at it, you discover all sorts of little interesting things that grow inside an onion.
I'm going to say that at 1:45, we're going to switch to a different bill because we have other people here to listen to on a different bill. So I'm going to ask people to hold your questions if you can. Do very specific questions, quick answers. We'll listen to other people on the bill. Sure. So at 1:45, we're moving, okay? Representative Thatcher.
Well, I just have a comment. Maybe he can respond to it, but it seems like there's an awful lot of, maybe I would call it overhead going into trying to make these analyses rather than trying to save money. I mean, it just seems like at some point there's a point of diminishing return, perhaps.
I'd like a request because Dr. Gluckman raised the impact or implications to the CCOs and the direction in which we're headed. And I know you heard the question, Tom. So can you kind of provide this body with how you see that working? Because I think probably everything we talked about this morning, if it has an adverse implication for where we're headed in this body and talking about health transformation, and so I think it's important that that piece of information, based on Dr. Brooklyn's concern, that we know ahead of time of what those are. So I really appreciate your question.
co-chairs, Senator Winters. It's a good example. In the case of the mental health drugs for the Medicaid population, the state pays for it, not the plans. So the plans currently cannot see that the fact that the state has paid for a particular drug. We found a way to provide that data as real time as we can within 24 hours of the prescription being picked up to the plans. In the world of pharmacy, it works the same way. The payer will have the data, and that data will be shared with Providence or whomever provides the medical benefits.
Just follow, because I know the skepticism in this building and other places, and I've been working with you on this 24-hour turnaround. Just as soon as you have that available, would you let members and everyone know that that now you can do a the claims data turnaround 24 hours?
Be happy to.
A couple comments about that. One is, I'd like to be sure that however the data is given to us, that it's actually usable by us and is integrated into our own existing platforms, because that just handing it to us a data file doesn't give us with the information that we need. And the second point is that in this attempt to define whether there's aggregate medical savings or not, it'd be useful to have good transparency about how the OPDB would assess the benefits of integration. So what would be their methodology to assess that? Because one of the things that we heard was that as we peel a layer of this onion, we find all sorts of things that we didn't necessarily expect. So I don't know what that methodology would look like to demonstrate whether or not there were savings or not.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and this has been just a fascinating amount of dialogue on what was supposed to be a fairly simple bill. But I'm going to make it just one more complicated. You've heard me talk a little bit about the generics bill that I think is important. There's also a little bill floating around about PBMs that I think is incredibly important and has to do with purchasing drugs. I understand, and I was just sent a text, that both of those bills have now been assigned to a work group to be worked on during the interim. It may be appropriate that this bill is included in that so that the connection between how all three of those particular purchasing of drugs not only work currently, but how they'll work in the future. So I'm just going to say that. I'm not saying that's where we need to go, but it may be appropriate to have that dialogue moving forward as a package of purchasing options for the state.
Thank you, Representative. Two good questions, and I'm going to dismiss you guys, okay? We got to get rolling here. Tom, how many lives do you insure in OPDP? How many lives do you have?
We have about 140,000 commercial lives and another 180,000 non-commercial cash paying lives.
Okay, and if a study comes out on a particular issue here, OIA or corrections or even Providence, who makes the decision? Who actually makes the decision of where that study is adequate, appropriate, real, and their savings? Who makes that decision?
Mr. Chairman,
I couldn't see it in the bill. Maybe it's there and I just missed it.
I'm not sure it's in the bill. The bill talks about the administrator of the OPDP program has some various authorities. It would be something that would be worked out with the various groups, with PEB, if it's a PEB one, with DOC, if it's DOC. We would not go in and say, you're just wrong, we're taking the program.
What do you mean by worked out? Somebody has to make a decision, and we can't make a decision here today. Somebody has to make a decision in this program if something comes forward. Who's going to make that decision? Does it speak to it?
If the data shows that one or the other group clearly has a savings, that will be
data. But who believes the data, who thinks the study is good, and then makes that decision is really important. I don't see that in the bill. Do you think it's in the bill and I'm missing it?
I believe the administrator of the OPDP program, the way the bill is currently written.
That's a concern for me. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to call up. We got a couple minutes to do this. I'm going to ask the next witnesses to be very quick. Thank you both for coming up. It's been a very interesting conversation, and I followed about half of it. Mr. Powell and Mr. Gardner, please, very quickly. And they will be followed by Stacey Cowan, and she'll bring us home. You've got about 5 minutes. Yeah, I think that might be the best way to go. We'll see. Introduce yourself quickly. You've got 2 minutes.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm not going to repeat any of Dr. Gluckman's testimony. it would stand as Regents testimony as well. The seamlessness of that data is vital to management of chronic disease through the Regents program. We purchase drugs for 750,000 members in Oregon, and for millions when you include plans in Utah, Idaho, and Washington State that are sister plans in the Regents program. We think it is unwise public policy to exclude those plans that have integrated models, and the DASH-3 amendments are designed to make sure those plans are not excluded in this program. There is nothing in the DASH-3 amendments or in that if they were included in the Senate Bill 1577 that would prevent an agency like PEB from contracting with the state RX program. There's nothing in this bill that would prevent that. We think it's unwise to simply say that it is a default policy that if you save one penny through that program, that you would do away with, that you would force an agency to do away with the benefits of an integrated management program. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being concise.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I represent PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Just for the record, in 2003, we were one of the original supporters of the aggregate negotiating program, which is known as OPDP, and PhRMA continues to support the program as just a good common sense approach to government management where you can achieve efficiencies through aggregate negotiating. It makes sense for the state to do so. Distributed to you my email of Sunday regarding a drafting error that we discovered late Friday afternoon and the corrective amendments, A5s, that were addressed in Senator Rosenbaum's testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions about those or any other aspect of the bill.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Quickly?
Very quick.
Thank you for finding it here.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, could you explain to me how Regents passes along the cost of savings, the savings that they receive to its insured lives? How do those savings get reflected in the cost that, that your subscribers pay for prescription drugs?
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner-Hayward, the Regents program passes all of our savings on to the paying subscriber. We do not have the PEP program. We did it one time. It's fully insured. And that those savings are passed on through the cost per member per month that's charged to the subscriber.
But it's not passed along in the cost of the actual prescription? I mean, forgive me, but I'm not trying to be dense here, but there's a difference in passing along the cost in terms of keeping premiums lower, which has been a challenge, versus passing along the cost so that if I go to the pharmacy and buy a prescription, then if I have a, if my copay is a percentage of the cost, obviously that amount is going to vary based on the actual cost of the prescription, right? So if you're buying that drug for less, then how does that, how do I save money?
Co-chairs and Senators Steiner-Hayward, I purchase through Regents drugs, and that is passed on to me at the check stand.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Stacy Cohen. Could you come up here and identify yourself? And we are, unfortunately, very short of time.
Of course. I'll be brief. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Stacey Callen. I'm here with SEIU, and we just wanted an opportunity to get on the record our support for this legislation. We worked with Senator Rosenbaum to reintroduce this legislation because we believe that it's important to look for cost savings in every agency and every possible line item, especially when we're talking about some proposals out there that would drastically cut services to Oregonians. In our report that we released last year, Moving Oregon Forward 2011, and then we further updated for this year, we did some analysis and we found that there can be significant cost savings if agencies were to switch to the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. If as we expect, the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority were to get about 8%, approximately 8% savings on prescription drugs, it would save about $1.5 million. million per year, $3 million in a biennium. I know that doesn't seem like a lot of money with some of the things that we've been talking about and the proposals we're talking about, but just as a comparison, $1 million provides 261 seniors home care for a year. It would also provide beds for over 10 youth at the Oregon Youth Authority. We did some analysis of PEB, and we found that there could be some significant cost savings there as well. We based our estimates on PEB of the approximately 8% savings based on what Washington PEB realized when they switched to their version of OPDP, as well as the 8% savings that OEB, the Oregon Educators Benefits Board, has realized in utilizing OPDP. And it's my understanding OEB's currently utilizing OPDP more than they had been in the past, and it's been successful up to this point. We do want to acknowledge really quickly that in Oregon, approximately 20% of PEB participants utilize Kaiser Permanente's pharmacy drug program. This program prioritizes keeping prescription drugs low. The 8% cost savings that we estimate for PEB in the report would not be realized for those folks that utilize Kaiser Permanente's pharmacy drug program, and that's a perfect example of why the bill was structured the way that it is, so that it allows an opt-out for agencies that can identify the cheaper options for prescription drug purposes. Once again, Senate Bill 1577 is meant to help save the state money. If an agency is able to identify prescription drug purchases, other options and that would be less expensive, then we absolutely would support them utilizing those options. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Freeman can't contain himself. He has a question.
I'm going to, in light of the amount of time that was taken in that testimony, I'll hold up for you.
Thank
I thought
you.
It was going to be quick.
We've got to get to the next bill.
Just very quickly, because you made a statement about opt-out and PIP. If the premise around saving money is that you're bringing everyone together so you get a reduced rate by volume. So if you start having opt-outs, do you still get the same or rebate, the lesser rebate that you're looking for? Because one of the arguments that DOC raised was that they're part of, and the drugs that they use, the utilization, is probably similar to all the other correctional institutions across, of which they are compact with. So they have a multiple interstate compact agreement with a number of states and a number of local county jurisdictions, and they're saying that you can't, that volume that we as a state can't compete with. So help me understand how your analysis then came out that we would be saving money.
That actually might be a question that's more Tom Burns.
I'll save it.
We can follow up with your office.
Thank you.
I'll save it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to move very quickly to House Bill 4127. Representative Hoyle has been very patient. Thank you for sitting through all this. Okay.
Well, how could I miss the fascinating testimony?
Yeah.
Thank
you for being kind. Mr. John Powell, please. Kim, can you walk us through the bill real quick?
Sure. Co-chairs, member of the committee, House Bill 4127 reinstates authority of the Oregon Health Authority Addictions and Mental Health Program to certify non-inpatient mental health providers for the purpose of insurance reimbursement. It comes to you from House Committee on Health Care, and there is no revenue impact, and you do have a fiscal impact statement. It is other funds. The bill authorizes OHA to established by rule a fee to administer this bill, and so there is fiscal impact.
No, I didn't quite hear. Did you say to reinstates or?
It reinstates.
You mean they had this authority before?
Yes.
Okay. Until 2005.
I want to be clear on that. And that changed in 2005? Mr. Powell.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, in opposition to House Bill 4127. The provision that these groups worked under prior to mental health parity was the same kind of provision that's in 4127. We ask that be removed when mental health parity passed because of some quality concerns we had coming from some organizations. In essence, what this allows is the state agency to require insurance reimbursement from facilities that in many cases have people who are not licensed providers. And I think this goes back historically to the days when there were not enough such providers in different parts of the state. But in our checking, we've contracted with a lot of these groups. In some cases, we contract with individual providers within those groups. This would require us to contract with the facility and anybody they bring within it. We don't think that's wise public policy in a day when we have providers and enough providers. We've just done some research on that to find that indeed our members do have access to quality providers in the communities we serve. So we think House Bill 4127 is not necessary. We would be glad to sit down with these people in the interim and discuss the issues that they have, but we do not believe having us forced to reimburse non-credentialed, non-licensed providers is good public policy.
Representative Hoyle, can you give us some insight about this bill?
Sure. So as Mr. Powell stated, in 2005, we passed a law that changed the way we certify these providers. However, the Oregon Health Authority continued to certify health providers in the same way that they had done previously. So they didn't change their standard practice. What changed really was last year the Attorney General's Office released an opinion stating that AMH no longer had certification authority and that these mental health providers were then issued a letter stating they would no longer be able to receive reimbursement. So there's approximately 50 clinics throughout the state, five in rural counties, and a number of which are in the good Senate co-chair's district that fall under this category. So we have people that are giving services. They're highly skilled clinicians who do not have licenses, but again have been in practice giving this care. And without that reimbursement, what we serve to do is limit the type of service that people, addiction and mental health services that people can get. I said, you know, either way, pass or fail, we do want to address Mr. Powell's concerns and Regent's concerns about ensuring that we have the highest quality providers. But a high quality provider, especially in addictions and mental health, it may not be someone that has a particular license, but rather someone who has the life experience and who has worked with people. So we want to make sure we have the right care, we have the highest quality care, but we feel that that is done through addictions and mental health certification process. So I think some of his points are certainly valid, but this has been our past practice. And again, I don't think at this time we should be limiting access to addictions and mental health services, especially in our rural areas.
Thank you. I hate to get into policy in this committee, but we do it all the time these days, especially in short sessions. Before I ask you questions, anybody else have questions? Because I have several. I vaguely remember something about this that was related to rural parts of Oregon and rural parts of Washington State, where we had practitioners in Washington State being covered by insurers, but not in this state, and we tried to remedy that, especially in areas of a lack of access for mental health and drug and alcohol treatment. Is that the group we're primarily speaking to? That's the first question.
Mr. Co-Chair, it's It may well be. I know nothing about Washington State. The five programs in Oregon that were referred to in the rural areas, my understanding, we have contracts with four of those.
And it looks to me like we're trying to put together a program here that is a new area of certification for people at this point who are not certified, is the way I read the bill, but I may be reading it incorrectly. And it doesn't, to my mind, require you to contract with them, it allows you to contract with them after they've been certified. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe this would give them, in essence, contracted status of reimbursement.
Well, do you have any comment on that?
sorry, no, I don't specifically know, but what I can tell you is that this has been the precedent and past practice up until this point.
In order to bring those questions up, I'm going to wrap this up so we get out of here at 10 o'clock as planned. There are many people in our communities, and especially in our rural communities, who are quite capable and very, very effective in this type of counseling. On the other hand, there's some that give me pause. And separating the wheat from the chaff sometimes is really difficult. And I would think the OHA would be a good place to do that, but I wouldn't want to put insurers in the position that once somebody was certified by OHA, they automatically had to be accepted. Nor would I want those people who are doing a great job to lose their ability to bill insurers simply because they weren't certified. It's got to be a middle ground here. I want to do some work and find out exactly what this bill does.
Actually, I just realized because I have really diligent staff, they've uploaded an answer to that question.
Wow.
So if you would, I have really good
That's
staff.
That's kind of scary.
So to address the insurance industry concerns, there are quality controls and safeguards in place to address the concerns brought up by Mr. Powell. Addictions and Mental Health draft administrative rules that lay out a number of protections to maintain quality assurance and enforce high standards. There are strong supervision standards in these state-certified mental health clinics. All counselors work under the supervision of a qualified supervisor who is a licensed MD, PhD, psychologist, licensed clinical social worker, licensed professional counselor, or licensed marriage and family therapist. The administrative rules also lay out very specific quality control standards, which, among other things, require that a treatment plan must be submitted to supervisor and their patient with precisely defined and measurable goals.
So what I'm hearing is they have a way of making sure these people are competent, hopefully. But is there anything in the bill that says you must then pay these people? You must contract with them.
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe the bill does. I know the bill requires us to reimburse them. In terms of contract specific, I'm not sure.
Okay. We're not doing a work session today. We'll get more information on this at a later time. Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could just close with again going back to the CCO language that you are all moving forward this session. Again, in that legislation, you specifically give CCOs the ability to establish measures that are designed to maintain quality and cost and consistency within their organizations, and that's exactly what a health plan does when they contract with providers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Any other questions? Seeing none, I'm going to adjourn. We're back here Wednesday. So we are adjourned. Thank you very much for your efforts today.
Thank you.